Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by Career Management Associates. I'm David Chulo. It's about all things in the human resource world. We're going to bring in local, regional, and national guests, and we're going to talk about a variety of topics and explain why human resource management is critical to your business success so that you can make decisions to keep and retain great talent. This week on the HR Power Hour, we're going to be talking with Laura Lobovich of the Career Strategy Group. We're talking about her new book, 100 Conversations for Career Success. Laura, welcome to the show.
Thanks, David, for having me.
Well, you know, what inspired you to write a book about, 100 different conversations?
You know, I used to run a job club in Washington, D.C., and I did this for 3 years. And over the course of my experience working with hundreds of job seekers in this job club, I realized that a lot of times these job seekers were really, maybe doing a lot of the right things, but they would get tripped up on those awkward conversations that we all have in our job search. And they, time and time again, just continued to say to me, I wish I had a script. I wish I had a template for how to communicate in my job search. And voila, that's how the book was birthed.
When you talk about having someone talk about the challenges, right, of being unsure of what to say, what are some of the things that, why do people get so worked up about that? Is it the emotion? Is it the stress factor? What are some of the underlying problems inherent with this issue?
I think it's the emotion that's tied with not having a job and the fear of having so much invested in that next conversation. Whatever that conversation may be, David, whether it's with, an actual hiring manager or a person of interest who may have power, who can introduce them to someone, who can make a decision for them. So there's a lot invested and wrapped up in those conversations, and each one is important, but they put a lot of weight on each of these conversations because, in the end, they want to get closer to a job, and, so there's a lot of emotions, obviously, that are tied into doing the right thing, saying the right thing, and so having, scripts that people can use and are repeatable time and again, it sort of takes the guesswork out of those conversations so they can just sort of be themselves, instead of worrying about what they're going to say.
Well, it is a high, stress situation. You're going to possibly someone you've never met who has the situation of determining if you're going to have a job or not, really. So it is something that certainly makes it a lot more stressful for individuals. How did you first come up with these scripts? I mean, where did you get this information to start with as you were getting this book put together?
Miriam and I, we built it as a networking book. So it's not scripts about, actual conversations in interviews. So it's an atypical job search book in that we don't talk about the actual interview. What we talk about are things like, for example, let's say you have just lost your job and you want to reach out to your network on Facebook and let them know that you now are unemployed. But how do you do that in a way that it sounds, not disingenuous and not desperate, but also like you really would like some help? And so we started to brainstorm some ideas. And we also talked to a lot of our colleagues about things that worked and things that didn't work. So, for example, if someone was losing their job and they went on Facebook and they announced, hey, everyone, I've just lost my job. I'm looking for a position in marketing anywhere on the East Coast. Clearly, that's not going to be as productive as someone who potentially could say, here's the type of company I'm looking for. If they can name the company, even better. The title, the level, all of those things, and often those conversations are not great to have right on your status update. So we were giving direction in the book on how to engage in those conversations and what to say potentially on, different social media, with your colleagues, with your former network, and how to do that in a way where you can have the biggest bang for your buck. So it was the awkward conversations that we were trying to sort of make more comfortable.
You bring up a good point. Today's social media savvy environment, there are different responses that need to be given on each type of social media network. It's one thing For Facebook, it's another thing. For LinkedIn, it might be something different. For Twitter, it might be something on Instagram. It might be on all the different sites that might be effective for that job search. How do you see that playing out, and how do you see it evolving since when you wrote the book right through now?
That's a great question. I think that because of all of the different social media, and you're 100% right, that there are different ways to work with and collaborate with your network on these different social media. For example, I have found that Twitter is a better way to get in touch with hiring managers than LinkedIn, simply because they're there, they're more social. I look at it like, you know, Facebook is sort of like your home, LinkedIn is sort of like your office, but Twitter is kind of like a cocktail party, right? So it's kind of in the middle, where people may have had that first drink, and they're a little more social and a little more willing to talk to you and engage with you because it is just that type of medium. And I've noticed that even since we wrote the book in 2012, that things have gotten more casual, and I'm not sure that that's such a good thing. Like, people are using text to, you know, thank people for an interview or thank people for an informational interview, and I think there's a danger there, and I imagine you feel the same, of becoming too casual in our communication. You know, certainly first it was, you know, years ago, David, when I started in this, and it was, you know, you have to write a handwritten letter, you know, a thank you letter all the time, right? Email was never acceptable, right? So now, you know, email is more acceptable, certainly for the more casual sort of, you know, hip companies. But I think people, there's a danger, again, in even going more to the extreme and, like, using text in a way that, you know, it really should not be used. So I think that's one of the trends I'm seeing.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely correct. I mean, look, there are many times I think people on Twitter have been drinking, but that's a separate issue. Some of the tweets, things that come across, I just go, really? Really? And you said that? And you wasted 40 characters to say that. Great. But you're right. In a job search situation or announcing that you've lost your job, really, the tone, the inflection, the way it's presented from a positive position, not necessarily from a negative point, which you may be raw and vulnerable when you first lose your job, really can make a difference in that long term, can it?
It absolutely can make a huge difference. And it can be the yes or no that allows you to continue that conversation with that person. And I think a lot of times, especially on Twitter, because you have this benefit of going back into someone's Twitter stream and watching their communication and reading what it is that they're passionate about, it's like getting insight into their life, you know, into their personal life, into their business life. And, you know, I think the propensity is for job seekers to just go and sort of immediately reach out to someone, but the benefit of having this sort of history, this historical perspective on maybe someone that you, you know, would like to speak with is great. Right. And so use that to your advantage before you jump in and make a mistake, you know?
No, I think you're right. We're talking with Laura Lobovich. She is the author of 100 Conversations for Career Success. Laura, talk to me about some of the key elements of the book and how does it help job seekers specifically?
It's a book about scripts, tips, and templates, you know, to help people sort of minimize their emotional distress, if you will, in going into some awkward, you know, networking conversations. You know, extroverts and introverts alike both need to network in their job search. And I've found that this is a great book for introverts who potentially may not feel as comfortable going out to a whole bunch of networking events. You know, this gives them some power, some comfort in having sort of the right words to say when they go out to these events. But also, it just helps with, you know, again, those awkward moments, the awkward moments on Twitter, on LinkedIn, when you want to reach out to potentially a VIP, someone, you know, let's say you're in a senior executive level and you want to reach out to someone who not just is a executive, but is a famous executive, potentially someone in the news. So we give some advice there as well. Also, one of the greatest parts of the book is how to be generous in your job search. And I know we'll talk about that too, but really it's very practical. You know, it's been called the Bible for job seekers because it is just, you know, you use it, you go to the chapter, you go, you know what, I'm about to write an email to someone I haven't spoken to in a long time. I want to get back in touch with them. I think they may be able to help me. How do I do that? That's kind of awkward. I haven't talked to them in 10 years. So it's just advice and practical tips on how to communicate with your network.
No, I think it's great. And, you know, to your point of staying connected and talking to people that you haven't talked to in a long time, I think it's one of the biggest misconceptions that are out there from a networking perspective is you almost wish that people would understand the importance of staying networked all the time and at least connecting, not just when you need something, but when you're trying to provide information and value to others during the entire career search and during your whole career in general, right? It just helps tremendously out.
Yeah, I mean, we always just say dig your well before you're thirsty, and that's very true. I think people who have been laid off and who have been through a job search before, I think that they're more apt to not let this happen, you know, again, because it's so painful to not have a network and then have to sort of create one from scratch or reach out to a network that you haven't spoken to in 10, 15 years than it is to just stay connected with them sort of ongoingly and then tap into them when you need them. So it is really important. I just tell people that, you know, 10, 15 minutes a day on LinkedIn is often all you need to watch what's going on with your network and stay connected with them. I make it a habit, and I coach my clients to make it a habit to go onto LinkedIn every day and go through the news feed and find out what your network is doing, what's important to them. Is it an anniversary? Is it a birthday? Did they post a status? Are they asking for help? What is it that you can do for them today on an ongoing basis? It will be so much less painful for you in a job search if you do this every day, even 10 to 15 minutes a day.
Well, it's the little things that make a difference and people remember you more if you're not suddenly getting interested in them because you need something. But you're actually, as we're going to talk about later, you know, giving back in some way or at least providing information or comfort when needed. You know, it's interesting. When you talk about the book, one of the things you mention in the book is you talk about something called a resume drop and run. It's an unusual term, kind of funny, but I did notice that, you know, this whole interview, we've been talking about drinking from the well, drinking in, and never mind, anyways. But we're talking about, you funny terms go together. Resume drop and run, what does that mean?
I coined this term many years ago when, again, when I had my job club in Bethesda, and I found that job seekers were doing this all the time, and because it just sort of seemed like the right thing to do, and it's the natural instinct to just hand your resume to someone who asks about how your job search is and just say, here's my resume, you know, can you, you know, look at it, or can you take it to someone or hand it to someone? And it's this feeling that I believe my clients and job seekers get when they hand their resume to someone and they believe that something will come of that experience, when in fact, generally nothing does. The people we're handing it to, they're not invested in us necessarily. They may really want to help us, but they also may not know how. The resume may not be clear. You know, it may not have a target at the top. That person may want to help, but that resume just ends up right in a pile of nothing, right? It ends up on their counter. It helps wipe up the orange juice. It really does nothing. And so job seekers who sort of drop their resume and run and hope that something will happen with it is a very natural thing to do, but it's something that I really tell people they have to nip in the bud. It's not a productive behavior. And so instead, you know, and I know you teach your clients this too, David, because I've talked to you, but you know, it's really important that job seekers get extremely clear on what it is that they want, even down to the level, the title, the target companies, potentially, the industry. And then not hand their resume to someone, you know, expecting something to happen, but actually hold on to it. Like, almost like, you know, you have the power if you have the resume, right? So, and ask them, you know, hey, I'm looking for a job at X, Y, and Z company, and I wonder if you know anyone, would you be willing to facilitate an introduction? If they say, you know, sure, let me take your resume and I'll hand it to them, you can say, great, that's great. I'd be happy to give you my resume. Would you mind giving me the name of that person and their contact info, just so I can follow up with them after, just to see how, you know, how things are going? And that way you're always sort of keeping what I call your job search power. And so the resume drop and run gives it away, and that strategy that I just mentioned sort of allows you to hold onto it and to remain in the driver's seat in your job search.
Well, and I think that's an important part, because I certainly know that we both would agree that the candidate owns the responsibility for making sure that these things get done. I mean, I always tell people, don't tell people to do other jobs for you. That's not what you're doing. You're not going to be successful if you tell somebody, you know, even if they say they're going to give it to a resume and then you're all surprised when they didn't. That's something that they're willing to do, but that's not they're going to guarantee that they're going to do it. I mean, your responsibility is to take ownership of your career search. And so you need to be responsible to make sure things happen. And you're the one that really is the only one who can rely on that it will happen. And so I think it's an important aspect that you do that.
Yeah, and it's also very counterproductive, David, because when you give your resume to someone, I think in some part of your brain, you think that they are going to do something, and it's just a hopeful, you know, instinct. And when nothing happens, I think a lot of people feel that it has to do with them, you know, not getting, maybe someone saw my resume and they didn't like me or they didn't respond to me, and it degrades their confidence, when really what happened was just nothing. Really nothing happened. That person never did anything with the resume. And so it's just all around an unproductive job search tactic.
We're talking with Laura Lobovich. She is the CEO of the Career Strategy Group and her book, 100 Conversations for Career Success. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB, and we will be right back.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
And we're back. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB and presented by CMAcareer.com. And today we're talking with Laura Lobovich. She is the CEO of the Career Strategy Group, and we're talking about her book, 100 Conversations for Career Success. That's right, 100, not 99, not 101, 100 Conversations for Career Success. Laura, thanks again for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Are we having fun yet? Yes, we are. That's the key here. You got to have fun.
Yes, got to
have
are.
Fun on the radio. All right. Well, you know, we're talking about your book, and in the book, you talk about a personal marketing plan, or a PMP. Obviously, a lot of people out there are thinking to themselves, a personal marketing plan, why would I be worrying about that? But in fact, as we all know, you're marketing yourself, right? You're marketing you. You are the product. You are the person going out there selling yourself for a new job. Why do you find it's most critical that they actually sit down and make a plan?
I think that it's most critical that they sit down and make a plan because I feel and that job seekers believe that they are targeting a lot of companies when in fact they are not targeting as many as they need to be targeting. And so in my experience, you know, if you have a job seeker who, you know, say, yes, I'm looking to work at several companies and I ask them to name them, generally it's 5 or 10 that are in their head. But if they're really targeting just those 10 companies, it's going to take a very long time for someone who is, I call it, has their butt in a seat, in a chair, working at that organization to cycle out. They need far more than 5 or 10 organizations that they're targeting. And so it's really a mathematical formula. And so a personal marketing plan allows us to get out of our head and really write down a couple of things. Again, I mentioned this earlier, but target title. You know, what is your title? What is the level you're looking at, you know, looking for? Is it VP? Is it coordinator? Are we looking entry level? It includes target companies. It includes potentially target industries, company size. And the most important thing about this document, I feel it's more important than a resume, again, because it allows our network, it helps our network to help us better, right, in terms of getting high-quality leads. So instead of, again, handing your resume to someone, you're handing them your PMP, and you're asking them to review it and let you know if they know of anyone in any of your target companies who they can introduce you to. It's a much more proactive, tactical, powerful document and a roadmap than a resume, because again, you're getting these higher quality leads when you use the PMP than if you just use your resume.
Well, you know, isn't this really a sales process? I mean, in fact, I certainly teach my candidates and individuals that come through our firm that, you know, you really have to have a mass number of numbers to be able to make a sale, which is the sale is getting a job. And so it really is a sales process, and you're using a networking tree or a sales tree to really get the number of numbers necessary to make that happen. Isn't it all about making sure that you really think like a salesperson?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely, David. I'm so glad you brought that up, because I use the example. I do have funny terms, but I use the example of, you know, okay, let's say you're a salesperson and you're in a business meeting, right, with your boss, and you're all around the table with all of your salesperson colleagues, and your boss says, okay, go. And you wear a sign and you walk out the door and you go, your sign says, I'm looking for this type of client. And then you just wait, and you look around, and you sort of wait for that client to walk up to you, right? That's kind of what we do as job seekers when we're waiting for a job to be posted, okay? Again, not terribly productive to just walk out of your building and wait with a sign for someone to sort of open the door, right? So instead, as a proactive salesperson, you sit around the room and you say, who would our product, our service be best suited for, right? Who are our target clients? And then let's go after them. And by the way, it may not be one meeting. It may be three meetings or four meetings. But by the time they're ready to purchase a product, we will be in their face and we will be in the door. At least we'll have a chance at that opportunity. And so it absolutely 1,000% is a sales process.
When people are thinking about sales, a lot of times people get scared, right? They get really nervous because they're like, oh, I'm not a good salesperson. Look, I'm an accountant. I don't do sales. Does this book help them really provide them ways to think past that point and get out of that comfort or uncomfortable zone, as you might call it?
I think it absolutely does. And we don't talk too much about it in terms of that it's a sales process, so I don't think people will be super scared if they read it in that sense. But it is a helpful roadmap for people. Also, it saves time, you know, if you use our book, because there's, again, 100 conversations, many of them in email, some of them on Twitter, on LinkedIn. We talk about how to create a really neat LinkedIn profile. So it's a time-saving measure. But absolutely, it helps to have this sort of a structure in place to save time and to get more comfortable with your job search.
You know, people think of scripts and they go, do I need to do this verbatim? I mean, how do they tailor it to themselves? Because obviously not all scripts work for all people.
We actually, that's one of the first pages we write is, this is not to be used verbatim. This is used to inform your search and inform your process and save you time and get you to feel a little bit more comfortable, that actually comfortable and confident and competent in how you're communicating in your search is going to be effective. And so a lot of what we write about in the book is aimed at helping job seekers to just feel more competent at, you know, writing emails to get read, you know, writing status updates on LinkedIn, communicating in groups on LinkedIn, communicating on Facebook, you know, how to engage with your network in a way that you offer help to your network, not just getting help from your network. And so it's general practices that we've found to be best practices in job search, because we spoke with hundreds of job seekers before we wrote the book. And also career coaches, to find out what is working today.
You know, speaking about who you did the research with, can you give us a kind of a feel for who you talked to, what was the background behind the book in terms of how you went out and researched and came up with this information?
Absolutely. So I am a member, I was on the board of directors at the time of a national, international association called Career Directors International. And it's a member organization, maybe 600 members. And we reached out to all of our, all of the career coaches all over the world. Many of them are in Australia and England, Ireland, Canada, of course, America. And we asked them, What are the biggest challenges that your clients are facing today in terms of communicating with their network? And we came up with a really nice list. And then, of course, we weeded out the pieces that were about sort of interview, right? Because we're not talking about interviewing here. You know, there's plenty of books out there on how to interview. This is not a book on interviewing. This is a book on networking and how to get people to help you in a way that is genuine. And so we worked with career coaches all over the world and spoke with them about, you know, what their clients are facing. And then, of course, both Miriam and I have job clubs, and we worked with job seekers for 3 years. Every week we probably met with, you know, 30, 40 job seekers. And over the course of that period, I collected quite a list of what are the biggest challenges that you're facing when you communicate with your network. You know, what is it that you're struggling with, and what is it that you wish you could have help with? You know, if you had like a coach that was sort of like, what is that movie, Cyrano de Bergerac, like with Steve Martin way back when? Like, if you could have like a bud in your ear, right, telling you what you should say, what would you want that to be, right? And so we collected that data from sort of career counselors who were working with job seekers all over the world, and from career seekers over the course of 3 years.
We're talking with Laura Lebovich. She is the author of 100 Conversations for Career Success. Laura, you know, your background, as we kind of stated before, really is that you're a professional resume writer, and now you have a resume writing practice in the Washington, D.C. area. We won't hold that against you, but what are some of the trends you're seeing in resumes today that not only are addressed in the book, but continue to morph and change?
Oh, I love this topic. I could go on and on and on, but we don't have all day, right, do we? We don't have all day.
Probably not.
Okay, so I'll just name a few. So one thing that I'm seeing, and that it's really, really important, and I like to use imagery with this when I discuss it because people have a hard time understanding it sometimes, but a career summary is a very popular and palatable way for recruiters to see immediately what it is you want to do, okay? What the career summary is a space generally about one-third of the resume, what sort of the top third, and we call this the prime real estate. And this serves as sort of the cover, the front and back cover of a book. So many, many resumes I see that are before resumes, before they come to work with us, they start with professional experience or education, and there's sort of nothing above that. But the problem with that, David, is that, like, for example, you know, let's say you went into Barnes & Noble and none of the books had covers, but a front or back cover. You would resort to looking at the book and sort of scrolling through the whole book and trying to figure out what the book is about. And what if all the chapters were about something different? So with job seekers, what if each of their jobs is something different? Then the recruiter that is reading their resume is forced to sort of jump to their own conclusion about what that job seeker wants to do next. And that could be right, or it could be wrong. And so a career summary serves, again, as the top third of the resume. It's prime real estate. It outlines, you know, sort of takes all of that experience into account. But the most important thing of a career summary is that it requires the job seeker to determine what they want to do next, okay? So we're obviously asking them to have some pre-thought, to do some soul searching, to figure out what their target job type is, or their cluster of jobs that they want to do, and to really target that career summary towards what it is that they want to do next. So that's one of the things that we're seeing a lot. So these super targeted resumes, subtle color, I'm seeing a lot. We did a resume for someone who was looking to get into Discovery Channel, and they did actually land a job. We used the Discovery Channel colors. That was neat. Two-page and three-page resumes for executives are becoming increasingly more popular. They're becoming much less taboo. One-page networking resumes are becoming more popular. First-person resumes, believe it or not, are becoming, they're still on the cutting edge, but they're being used more regularly. And just the trend of having, I just want to touch on LinkedIn a bit, having a very personal, natural conversational tone on LinkedIn, usually in the first person, which differs a little bit from your resume. So the resume is still a little more buttoned up, and then LinkedIn, you can sort of let your hair down a little bit and be a little more personal, which is a little more pleasing to read.
You know, you talk a little bit about some of the trends. We're also seeing video resumes. How about websites having to do with a resume? What are you trending in that area?
Video is king, obviously. People are, you know, easily able to create their own YouTube channel. They're able to put video-rich media on their LinkedIn profile. I do recommend that people snag, if they can, their own vanity URL, you know, yourname.com, if possible, before somebody else snags it. You can even redirect that very easily to your LinkedIn profile. The benefit of having video or having some kind of rich media that's out there about you is that you're going to land higher in search results on Google. Because for Google, you know, Google has a couple of sites that they find to be what we call high authority websites. LinkedIn is one of those sites. YouTube is one of those sites. Amazon is one of those sites. Obviously, Google is one of those sites. So, you know, if you have a Google Plus account, you're going to land higher when someone searches for you on Google than if you don't. And so those rich media is very important, David, but also just having a presence online on some of those major sites, because when someone searches for you on Google, which you know that they do, you will show up. And you will show up in a meaningful way, not just what is sort of haphazardly out there about you on the web.
Well, you know, it is important that people Google themselves and know what's out there, especially if you're doing a job search, because names are similar. And there are sometimes content and things that are out there you're unaware of in terms of making that happen. We're talking with Laura Lobovich, and we're talking about her book, 100 Conversations for Career Success. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB, and we will be right back.
Running a company can feel like you're surrounded. A key person quits. A big project presents itself. You need good people fast. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Our contract staffing service will fill a position or find the right talent for a short-term project. Hundreds of companies choose us because we deliver people that fit. Career Management Associates, your contract staffing solution. Go to cmacareer.com.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
If you'd like to be a guest on the HR Power Hour or be a show sponsor, send David an email today at info@hrpowerhour.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMA Career. And today we've been talking with Laura Lobovich. She's the CEO of the Career Strategy Group, and we're talking about her book, 100 Conversations for Career Success. Laura, tell me a little bit about your background. I know that you obviously have been in the career development area, but tell me a little about how you got there, where you started, and let's give the audience a little bit of an overview of who you are.
Oh, that's great. Thank you. I started my career, actually, at Walt Disney World. I drove a double-decker bus around World Showcase in Epcot Center. That was my very first job and my entree into corporate America. I stayed at Walt Disney World for 5 years. I worked in HR. I recruited around the country for them. I placed all sorts of professional positions, food and beverage, culinary folks. I actually hired some entertainers as well. And had a really great time there, and then I left Disney to get a master's degree in HR, and my background after that was in HR. I worked at America Online, and I launched their internship program for the very first time. So my background, of course, is in HR, in recruiting, and I left AOL to have children. And at that point, I think I did as many people do in their career, and they sort of lose themselves a bit, which is what I did. I ultimately found my way to a local career center where I volunteered as a resume writer, and that's how my business was launched. But the one thing I want to mention is that when I was at AOL, it was a particularly rough time for them, and I was laying people off pretty much every week. And I remember feeling sad, just really sad about that. It just wasn't, it wasn't for me. And then I watched them go, the people who were affected, I watched them go into another room and get outplacement support through an organization. And I thought, that's what I want to do. I watched them come out of that room after having help with their outplacement. And I saw that they, many of them were smiling and they were happier. And I knew that that was a service that I wanted to provide eventually. It just took me about 10 years to make that happen. But that's my background. I started resume writing, and then I branched out into outplacement, and that's what I do at the Career Strategy Group in D.C.
And you do a great job at it. You know, we're talking about your book, and we're talking about what job seekers should be doing. You know, let me ask you this question. What are you seeing as one of the things that job seekers should not be doing, should stop doing, really, really wish they wouldn't do this in their job search?
You know, I think, you know, there are a lot of people talking about this, and I think the one most important thing that I think job seekers might want to stop doing is to take a pledge to not apply for any jobs or start with a week, right? Just don't apply for any jobs online. The problem again, and I mentioned this earlier, but the problem again for applying for these jobs is that, one, they're competing with, you know, 50, 75, 100 other candidates, many of whom they don't know. And if you are one of those candidates and you don't know someone on the inside, it's very unlikely that you will get into to get an interview. And so what happens again is I call these serial appliers. You know, they apply to just a whole bunch of different jobs. And there's, again, they shouldn't feel bad about doing this. This is what we were told to do 10 years ago. But unfortunately, that doesn't work as well anymore. And so using that time instead to create a personal marketing plan, to start, you know, a networking sort of campaign where you're reaching out to target companies is certainly going to be far more productive and less morale busting, right? Because the more you apply to jobs, you cross your arms and wait for someone to get back to you. If they don't, if they're not getting back to you, then your confidence suffers and you go into a crisis of confidence and then you feel like something's wrong with you when in fact, in many cases, nothing is wrong with you. It's the system that's broken. And so I really want to tell my clients and job seekers everywhere that, you know, you can breathe easier knowing that in many cases, it really has nothing to do with you. You know, it has to do with the fact that you are working through a system that's antiquated and now doesn't work all that well. And instead, you know, try for a week to not apply for jobs and to get out there and to start networking more and really, really focusing your search.
On the flip side of that, you and I talk to a lot of people that are out there at job search. What is the one thing that they should do every day that they don't do?
I think getting onto LinkedIn and trying to stay connected with your network is one thing, and it really just takes 10 to 15 minutes a day. I think, you know, tracking the people with whom they meet is really important, you know, the quality of contacts. I talk a little bit about something called how information trumps power, and I want to elaborate on that a bit because, you know, ideally, of course, in like a perfect world, a job seeker will have a list of target companies that he or she wants to work for. And let's say there's 30 companies on that list, and they are looking for a digital marketing manager position. Well, in an ideal world, you would want to be networking with someone who was one or two levels above you, right? Because that's going to be the person who will either be in a position to hire you or recommend that you get hired. However, so that's the power, right? That's who you ideally want to be speaking to. Unfortunately, many times you can get into the company, but they can't offer you the power, right? Maybe you're meeting with someone in engineering. And I say go for it, okay? Go for it. Information trumps power when you can't get to power, okay? If you can get into the company that you're targeting and speak to someone even about how they work, what they do, you know, what the company is like, what the culture is like, then that information is going to help you to narrow down your list so that you can determine whether that company is going to remain a target company on your list or not. And so I think what people need to be doing is, one, have a company list. And two, start aiming to get meetings in those target companies. Whether or not that person is in your target department, I think is less important than getting that information so you can help really, really refine your list so that you know what companies you're going after.
That's hard for people to do, though. They do think to themselves, you know, I have to touch every possible point out there, right? I have to do everything possible, and I should just apply for a ton of jobs online because at least my name's out there, my resume's out there. How do you counter that thought of it's a quick hit, it's a quick win, you know, you get that good endorphin rush, you got it done. You know, how do you counter that thought process?
I actually say that exact same thing. I say, you know, listen, I know it feels good. I know it feels good to hit send and to think that you're really having a great day and you applied for 14 jobs today and you were really, really productive. But I'd like you to envision and close your eyes. In 2 weeks, you have not heard from any of these employers. And that's fairly likely. Let's be honest, David, right?
Oh, absolutely. No question.
Right? So I want them to envision how they'll feel in 2 weeks or in 3 weeks when they're still waiting back on those applications and nothing has happened. And I like to encourage them to get a little bit out of their comfort zone. If they're paying for a coach, it would behoove them to actually do what the coach suggests. And so I say to them, listen, I understand there is a huge endorphin rush with hitting send and applying for jobs. And so I allow them that maybe a couple times a week. But no more than like 2 hours a week or 3 hours a week can be spent on applying for posted jobs. And when they do that, I really want it to be their ideal job, right? I want it to be in their sweet spot, in their geographic area, in the industry of choice. It has to be something that gets them excited and they would love to get up in the morning to do. And then, you know, wipe your hands, pretend you never did it, and then try to get into those companies another way, whether it's by networking, going to an alumni meeting, going to a professional association. Now you need to try to find other people at that organization, and you need to forget that you ever applied for those jobs online.
You know, you talk about, and we all talk about, places people should go to find opportunities to network. What are productive, effective places for people to go to network?
I divide these into sort of two categories. One is function-specific networking events. Okay, so this would be if you are in HR, then going to SHRM, the Society for Human Resource Management, would be a great place for you to network for a couple reasons. One, you meet fellow HR people who know HR positions that could be open. Two, you can, you know, upgrade your game, you can elevate your game, you can stay in the know, if you will, about what's going on in the HR world. So that's sort of the first thing. I call those function-specific networking events. The other thing I tell people to do is to go to industry-specific networking events. And this is great when people actually have an industry of focus. So let's say you're an HR person, but you really want to focus on organizations that have something to do, potentially nonprofits, that have to do with women and children, okay? So you may go to, like, Eco Women, right, would be, like, a great example. It's an environmental association, very popular here in D.C. Maybe that's an organization you could network in. What's great about that is you're learning about the industry. You're staying on top of the industry, but there may be very few HR people there. And so those people may know of an HR opportunity, and there won't be as much competition for HR positions in the room, right? HR people in the room. So I like to tell people to have a nice blend of both. And to do that, of course, they need to have an industry focus.
We're talking with Laura Lobovich, CEO of the Career Strategy Group, and her book, 100 Conversations for Career Success. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB, and we will be right back.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at JacksonLewis.com. That's JacksonLewis.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour on Newstalk WLOB and presented by CMAcareer.com. We've said it before. We're talking with Will Lobovich, and we're talking about her book, 100 Conversations for Career Success. You know, Laura, one of the things that has been either a misnomer or something where people talk about it all the time is that HR can be a stumbling block for career for people looking for careers. Sometimes they always say, you got to go to the hiring manager, you got to go to the C-suite, you got to go to people who can actually make a decision. What's your take on that, having to do with HR versus a hiring manager? Or do you try both?
Oh, gosh. One of my favorite topics, actually, having been in HR and having been a hiring manager, I recommend that my clients personally, and I may get butchered by this, but I actually recommend that my clients avoid HR when the position is already posted. When the position is posted, the HR person may want to really ramp up that gatekeeper sort of response because there are so many people responding to that job. It's very unlikely that you're going to be able to create a relationship with them that seems genuine, right? We talked about that a little earlier. It's no longer about getting to know that HR person one-to-one because you want something from him or her. And so now you're in a position where you are not going to be able to create a rapport or create a relationship that's going to really have any kind of long-lasting impact. And so I do tell people that when the job is open, I sometimes say it's in many cases too late to establish that long-term relationship with the HR person. And so those are the times when you want to try to get to the hiring manager. Having said that, I do believe that HR can be a huge partner for success when the position is not yet available. Because this is the time when, without seeming, again, disingenuous, you can really create these relationships with these HR people. And then when the position opens, they're in a position to recommend that you be interviewed for it. So I do feel, having been in HR myself, and also, you know, having wanted to protect my hiring managers from extraneous candidates who I don't know, especially when I'm being bombarded by a lot of resumes, that it's better to create those relationships offline, if you will, when the position is not open. That's my take.
You know, in the last chapter in your book, as we wrap up the show today, you spend some time addressing the importance of generosity in your job search. Well, it would be generous if I got a job, Laura. So what exactly do you mean by generosity in your job search? Because I really want charity from the other side.
That's right. You do. You do. And I think that the way to get that, though, is to temper your needs to some degree. Okay? It's really important that job seekers realize that they have a lot to offer. And maybe in the moment, you know, that's not top of mind. You know, they may not be feeling so confident, especially if they've been looking for a job for a long time, but they do have a lot to offer. And I tell people to consider what their gives are. You know, what are the things that they know they can offer, whether it's advice about something or resources, recommendations, a shoulder to cry on, whatever it is that they can offer. They should bring that to the table when they have these meetings, because I've witnessed many well-intended conversations that really go terribly wrong when job seekers fail to offer their help, their suggestions, or to just fail to be curious about what that other person is doing and how that job seeker can help them. You just never know what's going on in that person's head. And if you can say at the end of every conversation, listen, I am so grateful that you took your time to meet with me, and I want you to know, what can I do for you? What is it that, what's on your plate right now? Is there something that I can help you with? And even if they say no, you know, I think that it's very important that you get into the mindset of, I have stuff that I can offer as well. It's just, it also takes the pressure off in those circumstances where you're not feeling like you need to get. More mutually beneficial.
Well, I tell people all the time, at the beginning of a job search, it's not about you. It's about what the other person needs, what the other person wants. It's about you once they're interested in you. But if they're not interested in you, if they don't get any attention to the fact that you are for them, the company, the person, the individual, then it doesn't really matter what you want, what you need, because you firstly have to get them interested in you, and then they'll be happy to hear about all the exciting, wonderful things. But it's really about what you can do for them first.
Absolutely. If they don't have a problem, or if you can't solve it, then you have no business really being in their room talking to them. So it's really about them, you know, and in any case, not just in a job, but how can I help you too? So no, generosity in the job search is so important.
No, I agree 100%. And it's one of the things that people don't think about a lot, right? It's just not a common phrase and not something that is taught typically in terms of thinking, you know, people think about their job search, and I get it. You know, they're thinking about themselves. They've got a serious situation. They're out of work. So I do understand the value of that, but it is something that they have to think about. Laura, I want to thank you very much for being on the show today. I think you provided us some really good insights into what's in your book. Again, we're talking about a book called 100 Conversations for Career Success. This information will be on the website at hrpowerhour.com. You'll be able to see a little bio about Laura. You'll get to see her great picture, and you'll be able to connect there to her directly, as well as you'll be able to connect to buying her book online. Laura, thank you very much for being on the show today.
Thanks, David. It was fun.
And now your HR tip of the week. There are some powerful tips to being an outstanding HR professional. This is according to Alan Collins, former VP of Human Resources at PepsiCo. He says, 1, you need to have an HR specialty. Even if you're a generalist and jack of all trades, you need to be a master of one. It makes you unique, special, and sets you apart from the rest of the pack. 2, HR results matter a lot, but relationships matter more. Performing and delivering results matter. They help you attract recognition, rewards, and promotions, but only up to a point. When you reach the human resource leadership ranks, this perspective shifts radically. Results continue to be just as important, but relationships you build with the organization can even be of greater weight. And 3, if you're an HR leader, nothing will make you look better than a talented HR team. Hire the people who are at least your equal or preferable, even a little bit better than you. To be B and C players will ruin your department and your leadership reputation. Those are the top 3 powerful tips of how to be an outstanding HR professional. And that's your tip of the week. Next week on the HR Power Hour, Pat Lynch from the Frontier Group will be talking about the 7 career coaching steps to help you prepare for your corporate divorce. It sounds sinister, but it's really important, and it's on the next HR Power Hour. Thank you for listening, and catch us every week at 10 a.m. on News Talk WLOB 1310 a.m. or streaming live on WLOBradio.com. Podcasts of this show and every show are available at hrpowerhour.com. Have a great week, everyone, and remember, HR management is critical to your business's success.